At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius John Bachelowitz, Germanicus Mark of Lejos. We're in Londinium, and we've been debating the heat of the 21st century. We can see that far. We now go to the equal bloody-mindedness of the 17th century in England. Recently, in a conversation with an author about the English revolutions, I've learned that much of the language and the spirit and the genius of the founders of the American Republic that is bogged down in Europe in the 21st century is based on, or should be based on, or could be based on, the successes and failures and bloody-mindedness and horrors of the 17th century in England. The scene is very easy to set. Elizabeth dies, having ruled over a nation of Protestants with Catholics remaining, from Henry VIII's conversion to what he called the English Church, confiscating Catholic lands. It is now 1603, 1604, 1605. There's a new king because Elizabeth died without heirs. The king is James I of the combined kingdoms, James VI of Scotland. He is in London, and he has a large family and a lot of debts. He needs money. Before that can happen, however, there are plotters, Catholic plotters, who believe that James, a good Scottish Presbyterian, remember he's a Scot in an alien land, believe that removing James and naming his daughter Elizabeth, who's 9 years old, will allow them to practice their Catholic religion without the persecution of the Scots. This is the gunpowder plot of November 5th, 1605. Remember the 5th of November. The plot fails. James takes his revenge on the plotters. The remainder of his reign, he dies in 1625, is practiced both in an argument with Parliament about money. James spends a lot of money on his relatives in Scotland, and he needs to build a fleet to fend off the adventures of the mainland. Arguments with Parliament, worries about the Catholics, and also James liked to enjoy himself. He was not a bad king. He was a weak king. That leads to Charles I, who is a strong-minded king who wants to rule without Parliament. Herein lies the revelation to me, Germanicus. The argument between kingship and the people turned on the argument of Parliament, commons especially, but there was lords, approving the budget that James I wanted, then that Charles I wanted, because kings needed revenues to maintain their fleets, to maintain their families, to maintain their sovereignty and authority. Those arguments turned into the English Revolution of 1641, and then the rise of the Puritans and the battles through the 40s, and eventually the regicide, the execution of the king in 1649. That's our revolution, Germanicus. That's it. The founding fathers were standing on the shoulders of the men, many of them anonymous, who fought those wars over religion, but it was over the representation of the people to have the government they want, quite contrary to what the king wanted. The king was to be a servant of the people, commons was to be a servant of the people, and the driving ambition of both was to be the safety of the people. Did you get this in your education? That it was the English Revolution that gave those terms of genius to Adams, to Madison, to Jefferson. Did you get that in your education, Germanicus?
In a word, no. And in large part, that's due, I think, to the surface landscape and textures of contrast between the 17th and the 18th centuries. In large part because historical narrative has created this idea that the 17th century was still the age of religious wars. And after all, in the U.S., with the Puritans, you had the Salem witch trials, for example. So the 17th century is still wreathed in a kind of cloudy haze of superstition. And it is not until the coming of the Enlightenment in the 18th century that the world, the mist is lifted, the fog is lifted. It's a world of light and reason. And also the 18th century, especially in England, looked quite genteel. And therefore, the manners of America were not given to the kind of bloody-minded excesses and bloodlust, as it were, that you saw so prevalently in the two English revolutions. And so that kind of made a break, and it was a clean break. And so we just learned about the founders. But I think it is essential to go back, as you have done, and understand that as Americans, the existential idea that is still complete and carried forward to our own time in the idea of originalism is that it is essential to know exactly who our founders were and who the founders of our founders were. In essence, that's because the core belief we have is existential. It's an existential postulate about the people ruling, as you so beautifully described it. And this is what is in danger of being lost today, as it is in so many republics, where the will of the people can be diluted and subverted, and where inevitably over time you have the rise of an elite ruling class that begins to arrogate power unto itself and begins to craft and create a world of rule for itself, which in order to maintain its authority and legitimacy merely requires that the people comply with a ceremonial acclamation of the elite's power through various political rituals that essentially coronate the ruling class and its leader, and then transfer to them the right to rule thereafter until the next plebiscitary or ceremonial acclamation. And this, in fact, is, I think, the situation we inhabit today, in which, as you saw in the Jacobean times, with Charles believing that rule adhered to him and to his people, the aristocracy. And he was in, obviously, for a very rude awakening and lost his head eventually. But the fact is that when our ruling class talks blithely about our democracy, by which they mean their democracy exclusively for theirs to own and to manage and to dole out, and when they seek to censor a people's speech and to subvert or quash any kind of popular candidacies, that gives one pause, and it makes it clear that for the U.S. to move forward as a republic built around the will of the people, it must go back to the well and truly understand the sources of our very special identity, and not to allow them to be reduced to a kind of mantra or litany.
Yes, we're a nation of law, but they had a phrase that I'll close with from the 17th century, a phrase that was used in Parliament when there was a debate about kingship, and used again against Charles II in the Restoration, and used again against especially James II, his younger brother, who was in the process of taking the aristocracy and turning it into a Catholic aristocracy. The phrase was this, you'll get it right away. The original sovereign power of Mr. Multitude. Isn't that beautiful, Michael? Mr. Multitude.
That is a nice counterpoint to what has been attributed, I think, wrongly, as it turns out, to Alexander Hamilton, where he was supposed to have said at one point, when confronted with the French Revolution and its ideals, he said, "Your masses, sir, is a great beast." And I think the counterpoint is useful because there is among America's yuppie ruling class today the same sort of arrogance and the same sort of attitude that your masses, your multitude, sir, is a great beast. And America, to survive, has to embrace ardently and with full innocence the idea of Mr. Multitude, because that's the only way forward for this country if it is not to to plunge into corrupt and authoritarian desuetude.
Michael Vlahos is Germanicus. I am Gaius John Batchelor on the Thames on a summer evening heading to the theater. I can hope for something besides Greeks. I didn't look at the venue beforehand because I don't like to disappoint myself with these happy conversations with a cup of wine. However, if it's Greek or Roman, we'll be back. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey, guys. Finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.